Good evening and welcome to The Late Debate with Cormac O'Hara. Tonight we'll focus on the political storm and wild claims in Seanad Éireann about the banking committee.
Now he's coming in to dump down on the house again by asking us to introduce something that Hitler himself with the Enabling Act would have been ashamed of.
And we'll discuss civil service reform on a day health bosses were asked to resign. First the news with Angus MacDiarmid.
Good evening. In Iraq, Islamist militants continue to push towards the capital, Baghdad. It follows the capture of the cities of Kirkuk, Mosul and Tikrit in recent days. The US President Barack Obama said this evening he would not rule anything out in order to help Iraq deal with the insurgency.
Iraq's going to need more help. It's going to need more help from us, and it's going to need more help from the international community. I don't rule out anything because we do have a stake in making sure that these jihadists are not getting a permanent foothold in either Iraq or Syria, for that matter.
A six-year-old boy has died following a road accident in County Kilkenny. He was hit by a car at the Lintown Hall housing estate on the outskirts of Kilkenny City at around 6:30 this evening. The road remains closed for a technical examination. A 20-year-old man is to appear in court in Dublin charged in connection with the seizure of guns and ammunition in the west of the city. Two handguns, silencers and ammunition were found when Gorthy stopped a car near Adamstown on Tuesday. Two other men, who were also arrested, have been released without charge. A 37-year-old woman has appeared in court in Dublin charged with trafficking two women into Ireland, as well as prostitution offences. The woman was one of two people arrested in Dublin yesterday as part of a Europe-wide investigation into West African people traffickers. Geraldine Rowley is from the support group Rohama.
Our service, we have met a significant number of women who were from, in particular, Nigeria. These were young women coming from situations of poverty, were lured to Ireland with the hope of a better life, perhaps school or a job, but then found themselves in debt bondage or in bondage of juju, which is a particular oath that they swear, where they then were afraid to leave their traffickers and ended up in the sex trade.
And the weather forecast tonight will be mild and humid with mist and fog patches. Outbreaks of rain will develop in parts of the west and north overnight, but it will stay dry elsewhere. Lowest temperatures 10 to 13 degrees. Showery outbreaks of rain will spread southeastwards across the country tomorrow with a few heavy bursts in places. Southern and southwestern counties will stay mainly dry with some hazy sunshine. At highest temperatures 17 to 22 degrees. That's all for now. Back to you, Cormac.
Gramila Mahagat, Angus, you're welcome back to The Late Debate with Cormac O'Hara, standing in for Audrey this evening. Joining me in studio are four people who are not watching the World Cup: Sean Fleming of Fianna Fáil, Sean Connolly of the Irish Examiner, Dr. Eddie Malloy of Advanced Organisation, and Eamon Delaney, journalist, author and former civil servant. We'll be joined later on by John Brennan of the Sunday World, who is watching the World Cup, and he'll give us an update. You can contact the programme by text 51551, email latedebate@rte.ie, and you can follow us on Twitter at latedebate.rte. Well, today in Seanad Éireann, the government was accused of losing its moral authority, political skullduggery and of gerrymandering. The reason? Well, the opposition claimed the government increased the membership of the banking committee from 9 to 11 to ensure it finally had a majority. Sean Connolly, you were present at what some people called a fiasco. Give me some of the background, first of all.
Well, I wouldn't say it was a fiasco. I'd say it was the part three of a fiasco that began last week. This has been going on in stages. The government intended to have, always intended to have a majority on this Oireachtas inquiry into the banking collapse because they felt that they should have one. But unfortunately, when the Seanad was selecting its two members for the nine-person committee last week, the Labour nominee didn't turn up, and neither did her Labour colleague. So Fianna Fáil saw a chance there and put one of their own guys on it, Mark Machary, along with an independent economist from Trinity, Sean Barrett. This caused apoplexy within the government because they'd allowed a huge own goal, and instead of just accepting that and thinking we can't go on, we can't be so blatantly, obviously partisan as to force our way through with this and just accept the fact that they were going to be in a minority on this this inquiry. They've gone through all kinds of shenanigans. They first of all accused Mark McSharry of having a conflict of interest. They didn't substantiate that and then had to withdraw that. The watchdog committee wouldn't deal with that as the government wanted them to. So then they came up with this ruse of just adding more people to the committee to give them an inbuilt majority. Obviously, the opposition were in uproar about this because it does somewhat go against the fact that this is supposed to be a new type of inquiry. It's not supposed to be partisan. Obviously, it just plays into Fianna Fáil's hands because they can now say that it has been politicised. And, you know, it's just there, this inquiry is there to remind people in the run-up to the next general election of Fianna Fáil's part in the financial collapse, which does a great disservice to the government people on the committee. The chairman, Kieran Lynch from Labour, has been an effective leader, chairman of the Finance Committee, and many government members on the panel also are quite distinguished. But this whole process now is going to be tainted. Alex White, a government minister, obviously running for the leadership of the Labour Party, which is what he had his eye on when he said this, probably said this is the sort of behaviour that gives politics a bad name. You also have government senator John Whelan saying the government's now a laughingstock, and many ministers are livid about the way that Enda Kenny's handled this.
Plenty more accusations besides. We should say at this stage that we did ask for a government spokesperson, but there was no one available this evening. Sean Fleming, this is playing into Fianna Fáil's hands.
Yeah, well, it's just more serious than the politics, and I agree with everything Sean has just said. He's given you a factual outline. But the whole point of why we're having it this way is the people were given a referendum by the government, you know, well over almost 2 years ago now, to give the Oireachtas more power to carry out inquiries. And the people said no, they didn't want the government to have and the Oireachtas to have those powers. So the government has come with Plan B, which was always flawed from the very beginning, because the power of any committee is, you know, constricted by the Abhilara judgment. They won't be able to have any findings of fact against any individual outside a current member of the Oireachtas. They won't be able to do anything, pugn anybody's good name. So people, even at the end of it, won't get satisfaction. Now we have a complete mess at the beginning. Fianna Fáil
is said, it a mess? Is it really a mess? Because it's simply, this committee is simply setting the terms of reference.
No, this is the committee that will actually conduct the inquiry.
It initially set the terms of reference and then the inquiry. So if you get the terms of reference correct, you'll have a better chance of getting the inquiry correct afterwards and having a purposeful inquiry. So really and truly, is Fianna Fáil making too much of what's happened?
Well, we're not saying much. I think the Taoiseach has done it all himself. Like, you remember the Taoiseach started off by saying when this legislation was going through, that all Minister Howland said he wanted to leave it to the Oireachtas, the terms of reference, the rules and procedures to be decided by the members of the Oireachtas. The Taoiseach has already given his conclusion when he spoke about the axis of collusion between Fianna Fáil and Anglo-Irish Bank. He's compromised it before. Now he's saying, I can't get the majority to force my predetermined conclusion through this committee. And it's just one mess after another. And he's doing the public a big disservice, because the public want to get the truth of this. And this is all in the way of the truth.
This mystifies me and mystifies many people. If we're searching for the truths in this, or as much truth as we can get, and bear in mind we've had a number of inquiries now into the banking crisis, does it matter who's on the committee? You know, we have this kind of, this is kind of, to me, a real Leinster House bubble stuff. You know, it really matters who's on, who's going to have the chairs. I mean, if ostensibly we have a committee which is there to find the actual facts, why is it more important that more questions can be asked in a more aggressive manner? I mean, and it also seems...
But if it didn't matter, why did they change the membership?
Well, I think it's party politics. Like, and the farce starts with Labour. I mean, not showing up. I mean, Susan O'Keefe, I thought it was a poor explanation in terms of helping her daughter deal with the leaving cert start.
She said an awful lot of people could relate to that.
Well, maybe they can, but this is politics, you know. And can I just put my hands up here and say, this is a reason, what happened today in the Shannon is a reason why I and many others went out last year and tried to argue for the abolition of the Shannon. I mean, this was just farcical on so many levels. Have a look at the clips there on the various websites.
But
you're right. So then why is it an issue for the Taoiseach? So the Taoiseach's playing party politics by adding two, because Fianna Fáil got two, and it just becomes this basketball game. The fact is, this is the banking crisis. It's something very serious. And broadly speaking, Fianna Fáil are kind of to blame. I mean, and saying that, oh, well, it's going to be partisan, you're going to say that we were, you know, they were in government and when it happened. So if they're looking for a clean bill of health out of this, it's just not going to happen, you know.
Fergus O'Dowd, Sean Connolly, Minister Fergus O'Dowd said today, it would only be fair that the government parties would have representation of some sort from the Shannon. As it was, they had none. Now they have two.
Well, yes. but they don't have any representation because they mess the whole thing up. And, you know, senators only need to turn up 2 or 3 days a week, less than half the weeks a year, and they get paid $60,000 for doing that. So if you think you're actually putting yourself forward for a very, well, perhaps the most important inquiry of the decade from the Oireachtas, as Susan O'Keefe did, she might actually turn up or decide, rather, you know, people can relate to the fact she wanted to stay at home to help her daughter with her exams, apparently. Well, then don't put yourself forward to this key committee then, or else turn up and get your colleague to turn up there at least so that you can get voted on it. There's another aspect to this, of course, because the people in favour of the Shannon during the referendum, in favour of keeping it, portrayed it as this great democratic bulwark against the over-trammelling power of the executive. And some of those people today on the government benches who actually purported that line during the campaign were lobby fodder again today, and they trundled through under Enda Kenny's command to do the executive's bidding.
But you can hardly blame the Shannon. You can hardly blame senators for that. That order came from the top.
No, but you can blame the senators who went out last September and said, this is a bulwark against the executive. You know, we have a spine in the Shannon. Let us do it. They folded over today and they caved in. But as Enda Kenny said, the government deserved a majority on this committee because that is the will of the people. At least he didn't say it was the will of God, but it was the will of the people. But I think he's thinking of the will of the people in February 2011 when they gave him a majority, not the will of the people last month when 70% of the population voted against this.
Let's hear Enda Kenny's reaction to what happened in the Shannon today.
Well, the events in the Shannon shouldn't have happened the way they did. I disregard completely the hysterical response from a number of senators. This is not about inter-party personal politics. It is about determining what the facts are for the people of the country.
Is that credible, Sean Fleming?
Actually, it just adds more to the issue. And the big issue here, I think Eamon actually said, the row shouldn't be whether there's 5 opposition and 6 government or 4 government or whatever. Like, this is a pathetic carry on, the whole lot of it. And Eamon said, is it about who can ask the most questions? We've always felt, Fianna Fáil, we should have an inquiry of the Leveson's type inquiry that people will know that happened in England. Yet the judge came in. He conducted the inquiry, lots of it in public. He got to the bottom of the telephone tapping scandal with various newspapers, and he issued a fine report all in 12 months. And that's the model we said, because it would remove it from party politics.
But it's Fianna Fáil secretly delighted about this. It's playing, as Sean Connolly said, it's playing into your hands, because if the inquiry goes against Fianna Fáil and makes findings against Fianna Fáil, you can discredit the inquiry.
I said to you at the very beginning, the people of Ireland refused to give the Oireachtas powers to make adverse findings against any individual or a group of individuals. So this inquiry,
you can interpret a report, though.
No, they can't. They can actually just report and present.
One can interpret a report. A report can clearly be written in any number of ways, and it can be clearly interpreted in one way or the other. If it's written in a way which can be easily interpreted against Fianna Fáil.
Well, if it's interpretable, this will go through the legal advisor in through the Dáil. If it goes through the legal advisor in the Dáil, they won't let a report out that's in breach of the Constitution and a straying beyond the powers allowed by the Abbey Lara judgment. This thing is limited before it starts, and we're having a row about a limited inquiry before it starts. We'd be better off with a Leveson type inquiry.
Eddie Malloy, do you want to get in?
It's just deeply depressing. I mean, it's taken 6 years before we started looking at what happened in the banks. I mean, it's more of the old politics.
It's dangerous. We have had a few reports.
They were short, sharp investigations by single individuals or 2 individuals, which went so far. We're still waiting 6 years on, and the evidence, you know, the trail goes cold. You saw the former head of the regulator, Patrick Neary, not being able to remember anything. You know, it's a farce. It's an absolute.
It's dangerous and counterproductive as well, because as the independent economist senator Sean Barrett said, bankers will also be gleeful about this because what he called the politicisation of the committee now, which is as it's going to be seen, whether that's valid or not, that's how the public are going to see it. It is a politicised, tainted inquiry now. Bankers, if they take any legal action against the findings of this committee, when it eventually does report, will be able to cite that.
Where do we go from here now, Eamon Delaney? Because the independent TD, Stephen Donnelly, who's on the committee, has already said he's considering his position on that committee because of what's happened.
Yeah, this to me is a lot of
Stephen's kind of grandstanding again. I mean, I know he's a big heart and passion for changing the system, but sometimes these utterances I don't understand. I don't understand.
Well, he'd be considered one of the better members of the committee, I'd say.
Yeah, but I mean, that's like doing even more damage. You know, why not try and be there and make the thing work? Why do the Saipan moment and just start trying to walk out?
Maybe he believes it's farcical.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Like, he also suggested there should be an addition of another member of the committee, another non-government member, and you know, the number of things they said didn't make much sense. I mean, I think Sean's point is correct that unfortunately we've got off on the wrong footing and it's been politicised, and you can hear even the Taoiseach wading in. I'm even surprised that he made, in making the statement he did, it's just the whole thing is growing and now, so it's just got this contaminated partisan air for what is actually a limited thing. So maybe Stephen should go in there and mollify things as an independent and...
We'll see. 5155. You mentioned Saipan. John in Cork, another rebel, says, is this the new way we were promised by Mr. Kenny? Sean in Wexford says the impartiality of the banking inquiry ended months ago when the Taoiseach spoke of the axis of collusion. It's not a government we have, a Fine Gael-led dictatorship. Enda Kenny isn't fooling the people this time, he says. Sean Fleming, somebody suggested to me today that the opposition members of the committee could simply step back, could jump off the committee at this stage and order a total rehash.
No, we won't do that at all. And Fianna Fáil has always said we will cooperate with whatever type of inquiry is set up to deal with the banking collapse and the events thereafter. And I'm quite satisfied the former senior people in Fianna Fáil will all willingly attend all these committees.
Why not declare a false start and start afresh?
Because I do honestly believe if Fianna Fáil was to pull out of this, people would say we're grandstanding and we're trying to collapse it before a start. I believe it has been handicapped at the beginning, but they will get on with their work over the months ahead. They'll spend months wrangling over conflict of interest to the different individuals over the summer. If they get over that hurdle and they get up and running in the autumn, I hope that the committee members will prove their worth and actually surprise us all and do a good job.
Surely any difficulty faced now by any witness before the committee, bias will be shouted straight away.
Yeah, and that's provided for in the legislation. There's an issue of personal bias of the individual members. The Oireachtas is an institution, the Supreme Court has said, is not necessarily biased, but individuals might be, and that's why each of the people who have been nominated, each of the 11, will have to be vetted by the CPP, and they will go through their track records, probably interview them, ask them have they any conflict of interest, because it did happen during the Dirt Inquiry. One of the members had to resign off of that PAC committee Dirt Inquiry back 10 or 15 years ago when he was found to have a bank account somewhere where he shouldn't have had it and never declared it. Sean, so that will all be gone through over the summer months.
Sean Connolly, do you think the committee at this stage is irrevocably contaminated?
Yeah, I would say so. In the public view anyway, and whatever Sean Fleming may say here, so many people in Fianna Fáil, at the top of Fianna Fáil, are delighted with what's happened today because they've got to get out of jail free card now. Whatever happens, they can say, well, it was biased from the beginning. You know, we were railroaded over. It was always going to go against us. It's a government inbuilt majority.
Can I ask you just one more question, two more questions about this, Sean Connolly? Mark McSharry, was he wronged in this scenario? Because he was pointed to in the Seanad when this furore broke out first, and somebody said he has a conflict of interest, but it was never declared or detailed.
No, Maurice Cummings said that the Leader of the House, the Leader of Fine Gael, in the Seanad, and he accused him of having a conflict of interest, but then refused to say what that conflict was, and then withdrew the remark. But that's obviously still lingering in the air around Mark McSharry, and it was then referred to by Ivana Bacik, I believe, the Labour Senator, to the Committee on Procedure and Privileges, which is the watchdog committee of the Oireachtas. But they refuse to touch it because they say, how can we investigate allegations of bias on a committee that isn't set up yet? You know, you have to sort it out first. But now that the membership has been agreed upon with 11 members, they will now spend the summer putting together the terms of reference, which Enda Kenny has insisted must have a government majority to decide what they are. And then that same committee, the CPP, will decide whether that's acceptable or not. And then they say that they will be able to rule on individual bias if there isn't any. I should also point out here that the government are making some incredible excuses for packing this this inquiry. Joan Burton today said that It needed to be expanded so that Susan Keefe would be on there because she's the only woman. It's kind of incredible that you know, this is seen as some kind of feminist victory, that there's one woman out of 11 people on this committee. That shows you, tells you everything you need to know about the role of women in Irish society and politics. Because obviously the banking collapse and the financial collapse and the Great Recession, they didn't affect women. They, you know, and their little heads, their pretty little heads, can't process all these numbers completely. So you need 10 men and just one woman to try and look at this.
Finally, Eamon Delaney, there's an awful lot of cynicism about politics at the moment, especially party politics, as you alluded to earlier on. Today's Red Sea opinion poll showed that there was a third of the people questioned that they showed support for independence. Is it as a result of this type of activity in Houses of Parliament?
I think there's a, yeah, there's a fed up quality out there that, you know, we're in the midst of years of austerity and you can't expect people to kind of give really positive support the party. You know, Fianna Fáil are still sin binned in the public mind, much of the public mind, and certainly Fine Gael and Labour are implementing the austerity. Labour went back on their promises, you know, you've heard it 1,000 times. So there is this independent, big independent vote out there. I don't know if it would solidify the local elections, we saw it, but a general election in a year's time or 2 years' time, it'll be, I don't know what it will manifest itself as.
OK, we'll leave it there. We'll be back in just a moment with more Samba-style discussion after the break.
RTE Radio 1.
You're welcome back to The Late Debate. It's Cormac O'Hara in for Audrey this evening. You can text the programme 51551. I'm joined by Sean Fleming of Fianna Fáil, Sean Connolly of the Irish Examiner, Dr Eddie Malloy of Advanced Organisation, and Eamon Delaney, journalist, author and former civil servant. The HSE told the Public Accounts Committee today it was heading for an end-of-year overspend of €500 million. An exasperated John McGuinness, who chairs the committee, asked for the resignation of the head of the HSE and the Secretary-General of the Department of Health, who are Tony O'Brien and Ambrose McLaughlin, respectively.
And as a representative of the shareholders here, and I'm sure if they were all here, they would probably look at you, Mr. McLaughlin, because you negotiate the budget, you know, in-house, before it gets political on the other side, and Mr. O'Brien, that both of you should resign. Because it seems to me that this is sort of Groundhog Day. We deal with the same issues every single time you come before us.
And that was John McGuinness earlier today at the Public Accounts Committee. We'll come to that in just a moment. But this exchange brought into sharp focus a report published yesterday by the Independent Panel on Strengthening Civil Service Accountability Performance. Dr. Eddie Malloy, you were consulted on this report, I believe. What can you tell us, first of all, about what the report recommends?
Yeah, well, maybe it's worth going back a step to see what was the problem that this report was trying to address. Pat Rabbit, in a paper delivered, quite a scholarly paper delivered a couple of years ago, pointed out that the existing situation is that secretary generals are not accountable to anyone. Now, if that sounds extreme, to quote Rabbit, the 1924 Ministers and Secretaries Act enabled civil servants, quote, to hide behind the skirts of ministers and ministers to avoid accountability. So I was involved actually in a very powerful committee back in 2002 involving senior civil servants, where we had a go at trying to resolve this, but it was ultimately fudged. Now, it was never written into the report, but I can tell you I was there, and the way we came to the conclusion was, you can't really hold secretary generals accountable, because if their performance is poor, it would reflect badly on the minister. Now, that is the exact situation that we have today. Now, a very good paper emanated from the Department of Public Expenditure and Reform around about January this year, and it was handed to that panel to process it. And that paper was very edgy. It really raised all the key questions. And I had high hopes that this paper would yield, you know, some real breakthroughs on this issue of accountability of senior civil servants. Now, it has produced some positive recommendations, but in a way, it's kind of held below the waterline in that it never really came to grips with the issue of personal accountability that have consequences. And that's the connection with the HSE. Because when Tracy Cooper, the head of HICWA, was resigning recently or retiring from the role, she played a really quite an outstanding independent role in scrutinising the health system. When she was leaving, she said, when things go wrong, when things go wrong in the health system, the problem is we never had any consequences. If there's a repeated system failure, nothing really happens. And finally, she said, we have still not cracked accountability in the health service. So right at the heart of our administration, both political and administrative, just to focus on the civil service, there is a reluctance, and there remains a reluctance, to accept personal responsibility that have consequences.
But this report recommends establishing an accountability board for the civil service, chaired by the Taoiseach, and for the very first time, it recommends the appointment of a head of the civil service. Surely that would go, those two things would go a long way to rectifying exactly the problem you outlined.
Yeah. Now, I've been arguing for a head of the civil service for a very long time. And the value of that is that if you had a head of the civil service, a secretary general would be accountable to a head of the civil service. Whereas at the moment, they're accountable to themselves or to their minister, which is like a closed loop, which we can come back to if you want. One of the things, for example, that the head of the civil service would be asking his secretary generals about is about, first of all, outcomes. In other words, did you deliver on programmes for government and promises made? But more importantly, in my view, is he'd be asking the questions about the capacity of their department. Do they have the right skills in the department? Do they have good management? Are they using information technology? What's the cost of their departments? And, you know, there have been a litany of failures, including the Department of Finance, which you mentioned earlier, Eamon mentioned earlier, where you had a bunch of generalists running a department. Mm. So a head of the civil service would begin to ask the hard questions about that. The accountability board is a good idea. Very good at you, because that person has to have an oversight like a board of directors. But I'll just say where the thing breaks down. There's a section called performance management, and this is worth just reading to you. It is frequently said that the private sector appears more willing to dismiss those who are not performing adequately. However, the private sector is not always subject to the strict financial transparency and constraints that exist in the civil service. In this regard, the private sector has more options to deal with poorly performing employees. Now, what they're saying there is, and then they go on to say, that if somebody's not performing well, they will put in more robust development measures. Mm. Now, what that means, let me spell it out for you. What that means is, if somebody is not performing, if I'm not performing, what I'll get is some development. I'll be sent on a course, training. Yeah.
But now, that happens in the private sector as well.
It does, it does. But there's a limit to that. What killed the performance management and development system in the civil service was the only outcome was further development and further development. So somebody could simply settle into a lifestyle whereby they could have mediocre performance and they could stay there for the rest of their life as time service.
But let me give the politician on the panel a heart attack for a second. Sean Fleming of Fianna Fáil, if you as a politician was forced to dismiss civil servants who were performing badly, you'd have a heart attack, wouldn't you?
No. And I think the problem is there's too close an interrelationship between secretary generals and ministers. Ministers come into a department, they don't know everything that's in there. They're relying on their senior civil servants to advise them. They go and present the script in the Dáil and they read out what's presented. And there's too much of an interdependence between the two. And there's not enough. I would actually prefer to see a bit more of a demarcation between them. And I've often asked the secretary general at the Public Accounts Committee in relation to issues, you know, what's the bottom line if you don't agree with what your minister is doing? Well, he said the nuclear option, he can write a memo under some section of the Secretary General's and Minister's Act to say he disapproves or he opposes the decision of a minister, but he is effectively writing his own resignation if he does that. And I actually think there would be a much stronger government if, you know, there's too close a relationship between the minister, and that goes back to the closed loop.
You've put your finger on a problem there, Sean Fleming, because surely everybody thinks that the Secretary General of a department is accountable, number one, to the minister, and then to a committee, a specific committee made up of various politicians who can question the Secretary General or the minister on any given date. Now, surely, if there is no accountability within that system, surely maybe the members who are on the committee are at fault.
Well, just on that, I want to debunk the myth that people might think that civil servants are answerable to Oireachtas committees. They are not. I have seen, I list the Department of Finance. I actually chaired the Oireachtas Finance Committee for a few years there in the previous Dáil. And after a couple of visits by senior officials in the Department of Finance Committee, I refused to ever invite them again because they never said anything more than was already on the public arena because they didn't want to say something they hadn't told the minister in advance.
And why would it be different under the Accountability Board for the Civil Service or the head of a civil
well,
service?
Well, actually, yesterday when I saw the report, I issued a statement noting it and saying it was disappointed because that's actually another bureaucratic layer. In my opinion, I disagree with Eddie on this. And now what we're actually doing is putting the 15 or the 20-something Secretary Generals over there and they have their own little board to report it. And now a Secretary General will have both the Minister to be responsible to and his Accountability Board and the head of the Civil Service. So now he's going to have, the thing will fall completely between
us. So let me get this right. From what I'm hearing so far during this this discussion, Eamon Delaney, the Secretary General is not, there is no kind of accountability structure within the civil service over him or her, not accountable to an Oireachtas committee, not accountable to the minister.
Well, in theory, they're accountable to their own department. They're accountable to their minister, accountable to the Taoiseach, and accountable to the Oireachtas, in theory. But of course, as Eddie has said, they're all powerful. They're the top of the pyramid. But it's hard to know. Like, they're not unaccountable. Do you know what I mean?
But
I mean,
who are they accountable to? Be well, be accountable, you have to be accountable to somebody.
Well, if I think of my own experience in foreign affairs, watching really powerful secretary generals, you know, people like Dermot Gallagher, who went on to be secretary general in the Taoiseach's department, at the heart of government. I mean, they were utterly transparent and accountable. I mean, I think that just to reframe it, I do see the perspective that they're all the heads of the pyramids. Like, just to explain to listeners, so the government department is like a pyramid and the secretary general at the top, assistant secretary right down. So we've got all these pyramids and ministers. There's no, apart from the Taoiseach and the secretary of the Department of Taoiseach, there's no overall structure scrutinising or making them accountable. And I think this is what Eddie's trying to introduce, and I can see why. The Secretary of the Department of Taoiseach is also the Secretary of the Government. That would be Martin Fraser. That's a very heavy workload. You were looking after the Taoiseach in his presidential-style Taoiseach that we now have, and yet you're also supposed to be Secretary to the Government. So really, in terms of making them accountable or performance-related, we don't have
and
that.
Martin Fraser would not claim as Secretary to the Government. He would not claim, and nor would his colleagues concede, that he is their boss in that sense, as head of the civil service. I mean, Sean is hitting on something here that Maurice Hayes, an eminent former civil servant, both North and South, said that the civil service needs to be reconstituted as the fifth estate. I think that's a very powerful concept there. In other words, a bit like the media being the fourth estate or the judiciary. And that means a degree of separation, a degree of blue water between the politicians and the civil servants, so that their respective accountabilities would be very clear. And that is not achieved in this paper. So, for example, if you take a thing like SUSE, the grant system for students, Rory Quinn got beaten up over that, right? Because it was a cock-up. But that's actually an administrative failure. And in the HSE, which is in the spotlight today, you have to distinguish between policies that the minister introduces and then administrative cock-ups by managers and officials in the service.
But if you do open up that chasm, a very different slight chasm, are you not opening up the possibility, and it happens already, when there is an administrative cock-up and a politician is on a programme like this and being put under pressure, he points the finger straight away to the administrators?
He doesn't always. He doesn't always. No.
Could happen.
With the opposite, actually.
No, the opposite. Yeah. They tend to cover one another. Yeah. As Pat Rabbit said in his paper, the civil servants can hide behind the skirts of ministers and vice versa. So you have a real problem at the heart of governance of this country, which is the conflation, the roles and responsibilities of ministers and civil servants is conflated. So you cannot hold either accountable.
Okay, a few texts. Rita in Lucan says, regarding public service reform, Eddie Molloy is spot on about the HSE. Having worked there, One thing I learned is that the higher your position, the higher you shrug your shoulders. Brendan in Dublin says institutions in Ireland, whether they be public or private, do not do accountability. As a nation, personal accountability is a cultural taboo. All the huffing and puffing about structures of public accountability are hot air. Nothing will change. It's our culture, Sean Connolly.
I mean, obviously that's patently evident by day in and day out from the door. It's quite an interesting report, though, even though it's written in a very understated way. I'm sure most people don't wake up every morning and think, oh, God, I hope they're going to reform the civil service today. But it does impact on people's lives and also feeds back into what we were saying earlier about the untrammeled power of the executive in this country. This is one of the most centralised countries in the democratic world. And when the executive has such a control over the door as at the moment, it's even worse. And so the idea of having a head of the civil service would be a good move, because at the moment the report says there is no centre to the civil service, so power tends to drift to the Department of the Taoiseach, giving the Taoiseach yet more power. Although there's a nice little line where they say that the head of the civil service should be guardian of the ethos and values of the civil service, which makes him sound a bit like one of the X-Men, but I'm sure it actually wouldn't be as interesting as that. But in Whitehall, the head of the British civil service has immense influence. The last but one, Goss O'Donnell, he was known as God, not just because of his initials, but because of the power he had over Tony Blair and Gordon Brown. He actually overruled Gordon Brown in November 2009, when the Murdoch papers had just dumped Brown in the most savage way and changed allegiance to Cameron. And then Gordon Brown suddenly remembered all this stuff about phone hacking he's been hearing for years and wanted to impose a Leveson-style inquiry then. But Gus O'Donnell said, the head of civil service, you can't do this because we're heading into election, it's too political. So if you had that kind of bulwark here, it might actually be quite positive.
Can I actually tie this report down to a practical example that happened actually today? And you heard the clip at the very start of PAC chairman John McGuinness exasperated, asking for the resignation of the Secretary General of the Department of Health, Ambrose McLaughlin, and the Secretary General of the HSE, Tony O'Brien. When that session was finished, Tony O'Brien gave his response to John McGuinness's call for resignation. Let's listen to what he had to say.
These are political comments. I'm sure Deputy McGuinness has his political reasons for making them. I'm not a politician. I have the task of running the health services in a very difficult environment with continually diminishing resources. And for that reason, I'm not going to enter into the rough and tumble of political commentary. I'm going to focus in the interests of our health service users and on our staff.
Would your new structure, Dr. Eddie Malloy, the one you just proposed, where there's a little chasm between administration and politics, would that sort the problems we're seeing right now, right today?
It would contribute to it. But there's another item in the paper that we're talking about today on accountability that might be missed because it's not that obvious. And that is that more autonomy needs to be given to agencies and departments. Now, for example, for a decade, the HSE has been required to hire a head of finance for about 150,000 a year to manage a budget of 13.3 billion. And they've had monumental problems with finance through all of that time. The same goes, they cannot hire, for example, heads of hospital trusts. Very difficult job, head of a hospital trust, 6 or 7 hospitals to integrate them. And they've offered 140 grand or something like that for that, and they're not getting them. Now, people may be politically correct about salaries over 100,000, but so the hands of the HSE, for example, the last round of appointments to directors of the HSE, that's the top 5 or 6 positions in the HSE, the HSE was required to confine that to internal candidates. So the Department of Finance and the government puts constraints on the autonomy of people like the HSE to get the job done. The civil service ground rules apply to increments, to all kinds of things, to firing people. So Tony O'Brien is right there that people are making political hay out of the HSE, and the HSE, for all its problems, and I've been a major, constant critic of the HSE, but I think that issue of autonomy, which is captured in this current paper that we're talking about today, is crucial.
Why hasn't this been sorted before now? Because if you look at what was said today at PAC, an overrun possibly of €500 million. Mm. Now, we have an adjustment to make in next year's budget of possibly €2 billion, maybe 1.5, it depends on growth. Now, if it could be brought down by 500 million, that's a massive saving already. Yeah, and if we could get efficiency within the public service or civil service, that could cut down the amount of the adjustment in prospective budgets.
Totally. But I mean, the HSE and the health overspend is a particular alarming case. But I just wanted to go general discussion. The elephant in the room here is civil servants can't be fired. I mean, that's really important. That's right. Here. So if you have a culture where people don't lose their jobs like they would in private sector companies, or if you're a football team manager and your team is doing badly, or you're in RT or whatever, they just can't be fired. So if you start with that as a culture, which remains, and there's a complete political unwillingness to change that, so therefore, you're not going to try so hard. I mean, I think these proposals are very good, but part of the problem I would have is, it's not so much about new structures needed as implementation of the existing ones, or getting people to implement. But where's the motive to do so?
But is it possible to implement a new structure within the civil service where you actually do fire people?
Yes. Yes, it is. It happens in other countries.
Is it realistic?
Of course it's realistic. If you say it's not realistic, what you set up is, people manage others as they are managed. And if at the apex of the organisation, it's written almost into law that nobody can ever get fired for incompetence or for all kinds of other things, that then translates all the way down. So you have a report from Wexford Hospital yesterday or today saying that nurses and other staff are not complying with the hygiene regulations and the management are powerless to do it. I've had firsthand, I've been involved in the HSE and I've seen really poor performance, and their boss saying to me, look, I agree with every word you say, but we're powerless to deal with them. Oh. That's a huge problem.
Sean Fleming, would you agree with that?
Yeah. He is quite right, and it is very difficult to sack somebody who is a civil servant.
Why should it be, Sean?
Yeah,
Would you like to see people being sacked because of poor performance in the civil service?
If there was a proper mechanism in place to ensure fair procedures happen, I would not be happy as a parent to have a child being taught by a teacher who was incompetent and damaging my child's future. And I think in those situations, there should be cases that if somebody is not up to the job, they're not just not doing a job, they're damaging other people.
But you can't put the cart before the horse. Before you discuss dismissal, you have to put monitoring and inspection and training
all of that in place. And I just want to take, for the benefit of your listeners, the only cases of people I have seen fired as a practicing TD have been maybe people like prison officers or guards where they had
stole
addiction
something.
Behaviors or they stole that's something a, or
I
they were
I
out
think
for
you.
You
have to shoot someone.
It's very serious. You almost have to do
I'd
something
put it to the test,
very,
Sean,
very
I
serious.
No,
they're usually criminal
but
reasons.
The last thing, just going back then to today's meeting, it does raise a very serious question that when the Oireachtas votes the €12 billion through to the HSE to run the health services, and the accounting officer for the HSE can come in and say we're €500 million over, he said the same last year and he said the same the year before, and he'll say the same again next year. And really, somewhere along the line, it does go back to the government of the day to eventually say, that is your budget, you stick to it. And maybe if a minister...
Maybe it goes back to previous governments where they allowed budgets to inflate without any inspection whatsoever.
Yeah, I accept... Well, actually, I can go back to Charlie McCreevy's time. There used to be supplementary estimates. We've had them for up to €1 billion in some of the last few years. And you mentioned the point, that's coming out of next year's money. But what's happening? People know tax revenue is up. So the people in the Department of Health know if we are €400 million over budget for the end of the year, tax revenue is up, so what? Sure. And the Minister for Public Expenditure will come in at the end of the year and say we came in within 99.9% of our estimate, notwithstanding overruns in specific departments. And there is no sanction for accounting officers who don't live within
the budget. That's where the new role that Eddie has talked about, and which is outlined in this report, could come in as a secretary to civil service, because clearly what is a turf war here between John Worth and Minister Riley, as I can see, over the budget. The Taoiseach is unwilling and unable to sort it out, and you could get there, you get the Secretary Generals from those two departments and bring them in and say, look, this has to be sorted out.
Eddie Molloy.
Yeah, could I just give you a concrete example? I'm involved in quite a substantial way with a part of the HSE, And it's a big sufficiently large chunk of the HSE, and it has a budget of 65 million. Okay, it has no finance support. Now, a factory making widgets out on the Naas Road with half that budget would have two accountants inside. So that's what I mean about there's no oversight, there's no system of accountability for building the capacity, the capability of the organisations with the functional strengths they need. For example, there are whole sections of the HSE to this day have no electronic records. And you go into a hospital like St James's and they're shifting around trolleys with people's files 6 inches thick. So that the you know, we don't have governance of the quality of management. And I believe, by the way, if you take the example I've just given you, there are definitely savings in a budget of 65 million.
Can I just ask the panel, and I'll direct this at Sean Connolly, first of all, of the Irish Examiner. Why are we talking about this now, 3 years later, in terms of looking at a report and theory about this instead of action? Because we have a specific department, the Department of Public Expenditure and Reform. We have it for 3 years. What's happened?
Yeah, it's a solid question, because obviously line one, paragraph one of the programme for government was that this government is going to usher in a democratic revolution. We've seen precious little of that. Today in the Shannon, you would say it was probably a counter-revolution and going back to the old ways. So, you know, there has been drift for 3 years, which is why the government got such a punishment, punishment meeting, really, at the ballot box in May. But there are other good areas to this report. It's written in kind of Sir Humphrey language, actually. It's very understated. There's one section where they call for special advisers to be reined in by their ministers. These are the people who get paid enormous amounts to give political advice to ministers. They're known as SPADs in the thick of it kind of lexicon. And there's a line where they say that permanent civil servants often find their encounters with special advisers, quote, challenging, unquote, which means ministers, please muzzle your attack dogs from now on and bring in a code of conduct. Because the only code of conduct that special advisers have at the moment is don't get caught.
Eamon Delaney.
Well, they're very necessary additions to the political system from the last 10, 15, 20 years. I think I saw them develop in foreign affairs in the late 80s in a minister's friend who looked over his speech and then became a much more powerful figure in the Fergus Finlay role, and then down to today. As Sean said earlier, absolutely correctly, that the minister goes in, he or she, faced by a department which is set in its ways, highly conservative, very opaque, not willing to listen to any new ideas, and barely knows its way. The Prime Minister really knows its way around the department, and the best thing to have is a good, strong advisor who has an agenda, a political agenda to be fulfilled, you know. And the report, I thought, was a bit blurred on that. The idea of having the advisors somehow answerable to the civil servants, that should not happen. That's a blurring of the lines.
But here in the last difficulties, in the last couple of minutes of this discussion,
political thing, you know?
Here is the difficulty. Despite all of the deficiencies that you've outlined, the danger is that this report, Eddie Molloy, won't be implemented. It'll be left on the shelf.
No, I began by saying there are positives in this report, but I did say there is a flaw in it, and we've listed some of the positives. I believe that the Oversight Board is a positive. I believe that the head of the civil service is a big positive. And I believe the reference to greater autonomy, which I've commented on a moment ago, and there's lots of positive aspects to it. But the one that really, for me, undermines it is the fact that ultimately there are no consequences. In the paper that gave rise to this report today, they define accountability, and it's worth reading it for you. The original and long-standing core meaning of accountability is the formal obligation to submit to a mechanism designed to achieve external scrutiny in explaining and justifying past conduct or actions, and with the possibility of facing consequences arising. Consequences have been left out of the script of this report.
Will this be implemented, Sean Fleming? Even the accountability structure and the head of the civil service, will that be established?
No, it won't. Yeah. And I'm telling you why. Because if the minister starts to do this, he'll be told by public sector trade unions, it's not in Haddington Road. That's the end of this. So, you know, we'll come back in 2017. There'll be all sorts of obstacles put up and say, Minister, the Minister has said with Haddington Road, this is the last ask I'm making of public servants in terms of pay and conditions. Bear with me on this. Now he says they want to bring in a mechanism where some of you can be sacked if you don't do your job. I want a new accountability board. They say, get lost. You should have brought that up. So I'm saying this is just pious talk.
But if there was, I'm not happy support, with
you. I'm not happy to give you that answer, support, but I'm giving you the truth. I do not see Minister Howland being able to implement this.
Would Fianna Fáil support the government in bringing this in, I wonder?
I'd support him with all the good aspects of it, and I gave the examples of teachers that can damage people. I will say this. Two things I would say, just as a practicing politician. Some departments are quite more open and good. Now, we're not talking about their financial management, but the Department of Social Protection, who deal with millions of people from year to year, the revenue commissioners who deal with, they have very good systems. At some of the smaller departments who just sit in an office in Dublin, be it justice or agriculture, who don't deal with the hundreds of thousands of people, are a little bit more closed and more insular. And some of those need to be opened up. And there's a good measure recently. We've had some Secretary Generals who have been appointed from outside the public service. And that's a good move.
Are we all being too hard? Are you as a panel being too hard on the civil or the public service in general? Because they do extremely difficult work, sometimes with meagre resources, and they achieve an awful lot.
Yeah, well, and I also think we've been hard about there being no change. I mean, there's been many changes. We have a government has an economic and evaluation service, which is an internal watchdog for upskilling, gaps in techs, communications and so on. There have been recruitment of outsiders like John Moran coming in. Not nearly enough. And the basic thing of people not being suspended or fired for not doing their job, and not just at a smaller level like that, but at an upper level as well. But I think there has been some reform.
Yeah, there has been lots of reform, you know, but we have to keep the pressure on. I mean, that if you think of what has happened to this country because of failures in the administration, you know, I don't think we can give any quarter in seeking out the very, very highest standards. And you only have to look at Denmark or Britain or Canada, and these things are benchmarked regularly by senior civil servants. They come back here and then implement half measures.
OK, we'll give the final word to the listeners. Max Weber, the great sociologist, said that the primary function of all institutions is the preservation of the institution, says Chris. Another texter says, I'm a middle manager within the HSE. I told my senior manager some years ago that he was incompetent. He told me I might be right, but he had the post and there was nothing anyone can do about it. Tracy Cooper was absolutely correct. Thanks, a genuine contributor, he says. My thanks to Sean Fleming of Fianna Fáil, Sean Connolly of the Irish Examiner, Dr. Eddie Malloy of Advanced Organisation, and Eamon Delaney, journalist, author and former civil servant, who are all going to stay with us until the end of the programme, because we're joined now by John Brennan of the Sunday World, who was not in Sao Paulo, unfortunately for you, John, but you were watching the opening match of the World Cup 2014 in Brazil. Brazil versus Croatia. The score was, in the end?
3-1 when I left it.
3-1.
About a minute to go.
Is it over now, Kay?
I think it's still going on.
It's still on the last few seconds. When I left it, it was, I think, 2-1 or 1-all. All goals scored by Brazilians.
Yeah, well, all four goals have been scored by Brazilians. A good start to the tournament. Maybe if you want to get the guys back into it. The talk is if Brazil don't win this tournament, there'll be a revolution in the country. That the hope of winning the World Cup is the only thing keeping Brazil together at the moment. So they got two very dodgy refereeing decisions tonight, a very soft penalty given, and a goal for the Croatians chalked off for what I would call a non-existent foul. It's called home advantage. It comes once every 60 years. You have to be the right age as a player to take advantage of it. It's no good if you're a footballer and your country hosts the World Cup when you're 8 or 68. You've got to be 28. I'm glad kind of a way it happened now. I was very afraid that a World Cup semi-final or final was going to be called on a dodgy decision. They're going to get after the refs now to say, listen, Brazil have to win this fair and square.
Will they win it? What do they look like?
I don't
like
think
in
on the evidence
play?
Of tonight, no. Now, Croatia are a good team and they were playing without two of their best players as well, one of whom was suspended for tonight, one of whom was suspended for the whole tournament for giving a fascist salute when they qualified in Zagreb last November. I don't think they will on tonight's evidence, no.
Who will?
I'd go for Argentina. Germany maybe, but the Germans have a mountain to climb. There have been 7 World Cups played in the Americas in the history of the entire event from 1930 all the way back. All 7 of them have been won by South American teams. So you've got to think Argentina and Brazil will keep that record going.
But if you're not, apparently somebody told me, if you're not from the continent where the World Cup is hosted, you're at an extreme disadvantage statistically.
Oh, huge, huge. As I said, the Americas win all the time. The Europeans generally win in Europe. Brazil have won in Europe. Then they took it to South Africa where the African teams couldn't make use of it. As I said, it's called home advantage for a reason.
Okay.
Now, the Argentinians won't feel at home when they get to play on, is it Sunday night? But they'll be comfortable with the weather. They'll be comfortable with the atmosphere. They'll have thousands of supporters in the stadium. They'll be just as good. Chile were my outside bet until the draw was made, and they were pitched in with Spain and Holland. They play tomorrow.
It's full time. It's finished 3-1. What about, before I open this up to our footballing experts on the panel, what about our friends across the water, England?
All duck or no dinner. They could fail to get out of the group, but if they do, they have a nice passage towards the quarterfinals, and even if a couple of balls fell right for them, the semi-finals.
You reckon so?
Yeah. The trouble will be the first bit, getting out of the group. It's the only group in the World Cup with 3 previous winners, Italy, England and Uruguay.
They have a tough one to start, Italia.
Very tough, and the Italian mentality, as Mr. Trapattoni used to call it when he was here, is just get a draw in the first match. They're kind of lucky they've Italy and England play in the first match. A draw will suit both of them. They might even play for that. The other bit of luck they have is Uruguay's superstar, Suarez, Luis Suarez of Liverpool. I don't know if he's going to be fully fit. He had an operation on his knee only 2 weeks ago, and you cannot play, if you're going to win the World Cup, you have to play 7 matches in a month. 7 matches in a month, 2 weeks, starting 2 weeks after a knee operation. Bit dodgy for me.
Brazil have won down. Who do you fancy for the World Cup, Eamon Delaney?
Oh, I don't know. I think Brazil, Argentina, it's the usuals. Not Holland this time, because they've languished. But I'm more interested in the kind of micro dramas like England. I was talking about last night, this whole thing of like, there's one flawed but brilliant player, like if it's not a Gascoigne, this time it's Rooney who's on his last legs really, but if he can make it happen, should they build the team around him or should they not, and the system, and also the way in which a country that we know so well with all these amazing clubs, but when it comes to the national side, they just don't deliver, you know.
Sean Fleming, Leash United, what do you think?
Well, I do support Leash, but I'm very fond of Brazil. I've been in it a couple of times over the years, and I do hope to win it. But they got off to a very shaky start tonight, and the first own goal, the ball passed 2 of the defenders, and a 3rd defender knocked it into his own net. Very shocking. But I think it'd be very good for Brazil to win as well, because Brazilian people love their sport, and you know, we think this is a big event. I remember, some people might remember, years ago when Ayrton Senna, the Formula One world champion, died. About 5 million people turned up to a funeral in Brazil. They just love their sport like no nation on earth. And it'll be good for the sport, you know, to have a good World Cup.
I would thoroughly agree with you, as long as they don't keep getting the couple of dodgy decisions they got tonight.
It's unfortunate, isn't it, that they get refereeing decisions, even though it is the host country. It'd be better if it was just fair from the
off. I'm sure the corruption already hanging over.
Exactly, It makes you suspect that there may be something more behind the dodgy refereeing decisions.
The conspiracy theorists are out already, because it's the same referee who was refereeing the night they were knocked out of the last World Cup by Holland. So the conspiracy theorists are out already that he was making it up to them.
Come here to me. The major Brazilian star, Neymar, how did he...
He was brilliant tonight.
Was he?
He was the one shining light, he got a... The first shot wasn't greatly hit. The second was a penalty that was almost saved. But all through the match, he was running at Croatia. And I was just saying earlier there, the 2 other Brazilian forwards tonight, who are joyfully called Hulk and Fred, if you put Neymar, Hulk and Fred alongside Messi, Higuain and Aguero, which is Argentina's front trio, there's no comparison.
Who'll be the star of the World Cup? Will it be Messi? Will it be... I've lost my train of thought. Will it be Neymar or will it be Ronaldo?
Well, it could be any of them. Ronaldo's carrying an injury into the tournament as well. Unfortunately, all our top players seem to be carrying little niggles, and you've got to be 100% fit. I think it might be any of them. It might be an Argentinian called Aguero who will finish off all the chances that Messi will make for him.
Okay, I'll take predictions for who will win the World Cup. I'll start with Sean Fleming, and we'll come back, Sean, and we'll say if you're right or wrong.
I'm for Brazil.
Brazil, Sean Connolly.
I don't know, but I'm going to lose it because I just don't get football. What? And I just find it such a tedious back-passing defensive game. I'd rather watch rugby. You'd rather be fast and everything changes.
Rather be in Shannon Dalen.
Yeah,
Eddie Malloy.
I'm back in the Irish junior rugby team to go to the final.
Yeah, so are we all.
Germany.
Argentina.
Okay, and I'll shout for England. So, Gnaidi Lib, Sossin, the Gramila Mahagir Fad, Sean Fleming, Sean Connolly, Eddie Malloy, Eamon Delaney, August John Brennan, Bamjadash, Jay Morch, Sloan.
The Late Debate, presented by Cormac O'Hara, was produced by Kay Sheehy. The broadcast coordinator was Maeve Mooney. The researcher was Richie Byrne. And Dave Gibson was on sound.